From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Sideways is the new critically acclaimed film about two men on a wine-tasting road trip. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Rex Pickett, who wrote the novel the film is based on. Also, 31-year-old filmmaker Jonathan Coet. He chronicled his troubled childhood with a mentally ill mother in the documentary Tarnation, which got raves at the Sundance Film Festival. Coet made Tarnation on his home computer from photos, tape recordings, and home movies he began making at the age of 10. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Arc of Justice, a saga of race, civil rights, and murder in the Jazz Age by Kevin Boyle. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There was dismay on Capitol Hill today over Secretary of State Colin Powell's decision to step down from his job as the nation's top diplomat. As NPR's David Wellner reports, most of the regret over Powell's departure is being expressed by Democrats.
Many of President Bush's strongest Republican allies in Congress did not issue statements on Powell's resignation, though Indiana Republican Richard Lugar, who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, did say he learned, quote, with sadness of Powell's departure. Democratic lawmakers had a good deal more to say. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont said in a statement, quote, the president should have heeded Secretary Powell's counsel more often than he did. Wisconsin Congressman David Obie called Powell's resignation a major loss to the country and called him the most responsible, thoughtful, realistic, and credible member of the administration's foreign policy team. Illinois Congressman Jan Schakowsky called Powell the lone moderate voice in a cabinet full of ideologues. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
Wire services are now quoting senior administration officials as saying that National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice will be nominated to take Powell's place as Secretary of State. The officials also said that the president plans to name Rice's deputy, Stephen Hadley, to take her place as National Security Advisor. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham, Education Secretary Rod Page, and Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman also announced their resignations today. U.S. military officials in Iraq say U.S. forces now control the city of Fallujah. 38 American Marines and soldiers died in the operation. U.S. forces have also launched airstrikes in Bakuba, 40 miles north of Baghdad. Insurgents attacked a police station and tried to block a highway with roadside bombs. At least four American troops were wounded. NPR's Philip Reeves reports from Baghdad.
The wave of violence that swept across much of Iraq in the last week has now embraced the town of Bakuba. The U.S. military said up to 20 insurgents arrived there by bus this morning, blocked the road leading west by placing bombs along its edge, and took over a rooftop. An airstrike was called in, and two 500-pound bombs were dropped on the insurgents' positions. Earlier, said the U.S. military, insurgents armed with rocket-propelled grenades and machine guns attacked U.S. soldiers from the 1st Infantry Division at a traffic circle and also fired on them from a mosque. At about the same time, a police station in nearby Buritz was evacuated after it came under heavy fire from insurgents, another in a series of attacks on Iraqi police across the Sunni Triangle. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Baghdad.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 11 points to close at 10,550 in active trading. The NASDAQ Composite was up 8 points to 2094. This is NPR News. In an effort to combat stolen and counterfeit drugs, the Food and Drug Administration says it will encourage drug makers to test radio tracking devices on pill bottles. NPR's Snigdha Prakash reports.
The first tests will be conducted by the makers of OxyContin and Viagra. Those are among the most widely counterfeited drugs in the United States. Beginning immediately, Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, will attach tiny electronic chips and radio antennae to the backs of labels on wholesale bottles of OxyContin, destined for Walmart and a large drug wholesaler. The chips will contain information on where the pills were made and on each stop they make, from factory floor to pharmacy. Bottles of counterfeit pills would stand out because they wouldn't have that information. But the technology is expensive, and it will likely be years before it takes hold. Snigdha Prakash, NPR News, Washington.
A man identified as terrorist leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has issued a call for Iraqi rebels to attack U.S.-led forces before the Americans finish with Fallujah and move to recapture other Iraqi cities. The call appeared in an audio recording found today on an Islamic website. So far, the authenticity of the recording hasn't been confirmed, but the voice is said to sound like Zarqawi. It says that the U.S. is concentrating its forces to finish off Islam in Fallujah. It says U.S. forces are overextended and calls on rebels to attack them with rockets and mortars and to cut off their supply routes. Zarqawi's group has claimed responsibility for kidnapping and beheading foreign civilians and for deadly bombings in Baghdad and elsewhere. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Vanguard Group, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The new film Sideways is being toasted throughout Hollywood as a shoo-in for an Oscar nomination. It's the story of a wine-soaked road trip that the New Yorker magazine calls a comedy poised at the edge of despair. Sideways is directed by Alexander Payne, who also made Election, Citizen Ruth, and About Schmidt. The film is based on a novel by my guest, Rex Pickett. Before writing Sideways, Pickett spent 20 years as a screenwriter and sometime director. Sideways was unpublished until Payne read a copy and decided he had to put it on the screen. The central character, Miles, is a chronically depressed, unpublished novelist and wine buff. He's taking his college friend Jack on a road trip to the Santa Barbara wine country the week before Jack is to be married. Jack is a big puppy dog of a guy, a washed-up actor who charms women easily and is determined to finish off his bachelor days in style. Here's the scene as Miles and Jack set off on their trip.
No, don't open that now. No. It's warm. Jack, that is a 1992 Byron.
Right.
It's really rare, okay? I've been saving it.
All right.
Please
I won't open it.
No. Jack! Half of it gone.
Hey, shut up. Okay. Here's to a great week. Come on.
Yes, absolutely. Despite your crass behavior, I'm actually glad we're getting this time together.
Yeah, me too.
You know, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. Beginning to think it was never going to happen.
Man, that's tasty.
That's 100% Pinot Noir, single vineyard. They don't even make it anymore.
The narrator in this novel is a wine lover, a golfer who has trouble selling a novel. I mean, this guy is and is traveling with his roommate from San Diego State. You also went to, I guess, UC San Diego. So this feels like you, huh?
Yes. Well, I mean, it's written in first person, and I had failed with a novel that didn't get published, and I had really hit rock bottom, and a lot of other things were going wrong in my life, and I just basically threw in everything in the kitchen sink. So it was almost my swan song to Hollywood. People think of me as a novelist, but I'd written and directed a couple features, and I'd mostly written screenplays, so I tried to reinvent myself as a novelist, and it wasn't working, and I gave it my Hail Mary shot. That's the God's truth, Dave.
This book was your Hail Mary shot?
Absolutely. If this didn't happen, I was gone.
Well, let's talk a little about the story here. I mean, in this, the one character, the actor, is determined to have a great time before he gets married. He's very confident and aggressive with women.
Mm-hmm.
The narrator, Miles, is much more fraught with anxiety about the whole thing, doesn't think it's right for them to be fooling around. I kind of can't bring himself to play the courting game. He's sort of so caught up in his own insecurities. Is that what you were like on a trip?
I think so. I mean, I was in the early 90s. My now ex-wife and I drifted apart. We'd made some films together, and we're very close still to this day, and I adore. And I did some things that probably weren't good in a marriage, and I regret it. And I'm just being honest with you. And so, even though this novel is fiction, the events in it are fiction, I wanted to set up a situation where I just, wanted to comment on male behavior in the case of Jack and the fact that Miles is disapproving. And it makes it difficult for him to establish a relationship with the person Jack is, having the affair with, because she's the best friend of this woman he's interested in. So he's put in a compromise situation, which creates, tension and drama.
I wonder if men who And when I was in single, when I was single, I was in this category. Didn't find it particularly easy to take the initiative with women they didn't know. Need someone with them who kind of throws caution to the wind and plunges them into situations that they're nervous about because they're insecure. They don't want to take the emotional risk of it. Do you think guys like us need a jack to drag us into things that we're afraid of?
Yeah, I guess I just heard this term wingman. I guess it's been around. I guess he's the ultimate wingman. I used to say something, it's pure hyperbole, but I've said 90% of the women, single women out there, are dating 10% of the men because they're the jacks in the world who will just, you know, they have a certain charisma about them. They have a certain half glass full quality about them that they will just open themselves up. If in fact you're describing yourself, I'm like you, I'm shyer. It takes me a lot longer. I need a lot of signals. I need the woman to actually make the first move in most cases. So, you know, I think the Mileses of the world need the Jacks in the world in order if they're going to, you know, come out.
The character, the Miles that's in the movie is not a particularly good golfer. I noticed that the Miles who's in your book is a pretty darn good golfer. Which are you?
Well, I had my handicap down to 2, so I like to think I'm a pretty good golfer. I played a lot of golf, and it's kind of funny. I guess they spent $2,000 to give Paul golf lessons, and he was terrified. And they could have paid me nothing, and I would have, I think, done a better job. He has a horrific golf swing. It's so bad, I don't think they would even let him on the golf course. But it kind of works in the movie because he's so frustrated with his life. He might as well also be frustrated with the game that's the most frustrating game on the planet. Actually, it's just a little anecdote, the golf shot that he hits back at the foursome when you see the movie, and
I think it's a great story. Why don't
set
you
it up
for those who haven't seen the movie? Why don't you describe the scene?
Well, this is a scene right out of the novel. I mean, the two of them are arguing and bickering about something, and his frustration, and Jack's trying to, you know, coax him out and, you know, have him feel a little more, you know, optimistic about his future. And this group behind them hit a ball into him, which on a golf course is just is rude. It's unheard of. You don't do it. And so, and this has actually happened to me. And Miles goes over and picks up the golf ball and just hits it right back at them, which is vaguely dangerous. And I've done that before. And so when he got there, I was on the set that day, and they actually had me hit that golf shot, which was my favorite moment in the movie.
In movies where stunts are controlled, but usually
right,
by professional stunt guys, they actually had you
right,
place a golf ball and then hit what a 3-wood back,
yeah,
like 200 yards back.
Actually, no, that's the way it should have been. But for the, you know, the sake of, you know, movie distances, 200 yards away, you would never have seen them. So they put them only 100 yards away, and it was kind of a trick golf shot. I had to choke way down on a 3-iron and really hit it low. And it was kind of dangerous because I was really rifling golf balls at these four people who were sitting up there, and one of them hit the golf cart, but they made it look like Paul hit the shot, but I don't think anyone who sees his swing would ever think he could hit it.
Well, for anybody who doesn't play golf, I can testify that's really hard to do. Most people almost hit people by accident. It's much harder to do on purpose. The character Miles in the book also refers to carrying around Xanax, which I guess is an anti-anxiety medication,
mm-hmm,
and having had recent hospitalizations. I mean, have you had that kind of a troubled emotional history yourself?
And it's not that troubled. In the early 90s, my mother had a stroke, and my younger brother took over her care and kind of gutted all her money. And, you know, as I said, my wife and I, who had had a partnership making films together, we drifted apart, and I went down to take over my mother's care, and then I got a phone call that my agent had passed away from AIDS. It was a tough time, and I started having panic anxiety, and so I found, you know, it's medication, but I don't take it on a daily basis. I may go 2 months and not even take one, but if I'm feeling panicky, you know, I'll take a half of one and try to overcome it. The only time it really surfaces now is flying. That's the only time, but...
So you have difficulty with flying, Rex? That's a phobia.
Yeah, I think I just got over it because I was in New York for 3 weeks, and I was gonna they held me on for a film benefit there, and I was gonna take an Amtrak back. So I got on an Amtrak out of New York, and I had a luxury sleeper car, and it was about half the size of the bathroom I was staying in the hotel where I was staying, and I started feeling kind of panicky on the train. I couldn't sleep. I was being pitched back and forth, and then at 3 a.m, the train caught on fire, and they had to call 911. It was an absolute nightmare. So I detrained myself in Chicago and called my girlfriend. She flew out, and we flew back, and I had never been so happy to be hurtling at 35,000 feet or where at 500 miles an hour. So I think Amtrak cured me of my aerophobia.
Wow, so you found a new cure for fear of flying, set the train on fire, huh?
Well, I just, you know, any form of travel like that, I mean, where you don't have any control. But no, I think, you know, I'm pretty much over it now.
In the book Sideways, these two characters, Miles and Jack, are on a wine-tasting road trip in the Santa Barbara wine country, which is almost a character in this novel. And do you think this setting and this world of wine appreciation brings to the story?
Well, I think, you know, were these two guys on a bachelor trip just drinking beer, it wouldn't have the sense of, I don't know, romance about it. I mean, Miles has found I've read a lot of reviews and people say different things. He seems to have found a refuge from his depression and his loneliness in wine. But really, he has a passion for something that you can really have a passion for, which I have a real passion for. I mean, there are so many different countries of origin and varietals and different winemakers and different years. And there's a whole book side to wine appreciation that is just as fascinating to me as actual experience. And I think he's eager to involve other people in that passion, in this case, Jack, who really doesn't have that appreciation. So, and I love the beauty of the terrain. There's a feeling, I don't know, seeing the movie, but I've never been to Tuscany, but it looks a little bit like a kind of a Southern California version of Tuscany. So as a writer, I really believe in setting where I've been, not trying to create a place. And I really believe in real places, real wine tasting. And I don't even think it would have worked if it was Napa Sonoma. I mean, God bless them, they make great wines up there. But there was something unique. I think a lot of people haven't discovered this little corner of the world. I know Alexander really, he moved up there 3.5 months before he even began shooting the
now,
film.
Alexander Payne, who is the director
Alexander
of the film.
Payne, the director and writer, co-writer with his partner Jim Taylor. And he moved up there, and he just steeped himself in that train. And he loved the verisimilitude of the locations. I mean, the locations weren't made up. There really is a Hitching Post, and there really is a Foxen Winery, and in Sanford Winery. All these places are up there, and you can actually see the movie and read the book and go up and take a tour of the book and the movie.
But, you know, it's interesting because I'm somebody who enjoys a glass of wine with dinner, but I don't really know anything about it. But this movie and the book were filled with these phrases like the wine was richly oaked with just enough forward fruit. And I don't know what any of this stuff means, but when I hear it and read it, I can taste red wine. It sort of adds some kind of sensual quality to the experience.
Right. Well, I mean, there are like two camps of people who are wine appreciators of what we call, or what I've actually termed, wine speak. And I'm in the camp where Robert Parker is like the great hyperbole artist of this. And, you know, he speaks grandiloquently, almost sometimes ridiculously, where he'll say, for instance, a certain Shiraz tasted like melting asphalt. I mean, I don't know if he's ever had melting asphalt. But I love the poetry of the language, where people are really trying to reach for descriptions, as absurd and as exaggerated as many of them are. As being a writer, I love that. I love reaching for it myself. And as you get into your first and second and third glass, you become ever more glib. And I like it. And I get a lot of it from a friend of mine who taught me a lot about wine, Julian Davies. We would go back and forth with it. And we really enjoyed that kind of wine speak repartee, as it were.
One other example, the wine was dark and unfiltered, but it had a kind of feral richness that called to me. Was that your own phrase?
Yeah, that is.
Very nice.
That's from the novel. They didn't use it in the movie, but they used a lot of other quaffable but transcendent, quaffable but far from transcendent, that's right out of the book, and some other ones. They riffed on it. Alexander is and Jim, Alexander in particular really knows wine, and he learned even a lot more making this movie.
What wine was that with the dark and unfiltered but feral richness?
I think that was a Sanford 99 La Rinconada. It was actually one of the first wines I had up there. It's one of the great wineries up there, and they have a great tasting room. In fact, the opening scene where Miles is showing Jack, you know, how to actually go through tasting or whatever, and it's a little over the top for me, but the audience really likes it. That is actually at the Sanford Tasting Room, and the guy pouring the wine actually works there, Chris Burrows. He's a great guy. But that's the La Rinconada is one of their high-end Pinot Noirs, and it's just a very, very thrilling wine. I remember going up there with Alexander and Sandra Oh, his wife, and some other people involved in the movie, and we sat at a picnic table, and we drank it. And we just, it, it, I don't know, it called to me with its feral richness.
One of the lines from the book, which is in the movie, is when Miles and his friend Jack are about to go into a restaurant for a double date, which Miles is pretty anxious about. And he says, look, if they order Merlot, I'm leaving. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with Merlot? Do you ever drink Merlot?
Well, there are great Merlots. I mean, Chateau Petrus is 100% Merlot, and it's one of the great wines and one of the most expensive wines around. The Merlot that we get in California is really for unsophisticated palates. It's a soft, flabby, uncomplex wine. It's known in Bordeaux, of course, as a blending varietal. It actually softens the harsher, more tannic Cabernet. It's not really, with few exceptions like, you know, Chateau Petrus, it's not really meant to be 100% used 100% in a given wine. It's a blending varietal, and there are good Merlots here, like Duckhorn Vineyards up in Napa, and there are other ones. So I'm not totally against Merlot, but I find it to taste similar from bottle to bottle. Whereas Pinot Noir, which is the grape I absolutely adore, is so different from bottle to bottle. Its expression is so different, and you can go broke chasing it. But I sort of love that aspect of it.
Rex Pickett. His novel Sideways has been made into a feature film by Alexander Payne. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Rex Pickett. His novel Sideways is now a feature film. It tells the story of two men on a wine-soaked road trip. Jack is about to marry, Miles is recovering from a divorce, and he's just learned his ex is about to remarry. One of the things that Miles does when he's struggling to get over it is one night when he's on a double date with Jack and these two women, he's had deeply into his cups of the grape, and he secretly goes off and phones his ex-wife. Jack says to him, did you drink and dial? Did you drink and dial? And where did that phrase come up with? Where did that phrase come from?
I don't know if I'm not quite sure where the phrase comes. It might be one of those phrases they use in AA or something. I wouldn't know. But it's, sometimes when you've had a little too much, you start, calling friends or whatever. Actually, that never really happened to me in real life, but it is right from the novel. There's no question. I felt like, there was something that was, he almost couldn't deal with it sober. But once he'd had, he had enough grape in it, it sort of liberated him enough to call her and confront her on the fact that, and he just wanted to know. And there's something that's a very tough scene for me to watch. It's very, very, very painful. And I love the way they directed it, too, using the camera angles they did. They really gave you the sense that Miles was really not, not in his right mind at that moment.
You know, it's ironic that you've written a lot of Hollywood screenplays. I mean, you've been doing this for a lot of years, and some have been produced. But your biggest movie is going to come from this novel, which was unpublished until it was adapted by Alexander Payne and Jim Taylor. It's a very dialogue-rich novel, I'll say. What made you want to tell this story in a novel rather than a screenplay?
Well, actually, Dave, I originally wrote it as a screenplay, and it didn't work for me, and it so didn't work, I didn't even show it to my agent. A lot of writers ultimately get representation out there should take note. Don't show everything to your agent. But there was something in the story, and I started to write a short story in the first person of Miles where he goes to a wine tasting that kind of goes out of control. And when I got to the end of that short story, I thought, oh, my gosh, I can have Jack show up now, and they're ready to take off. He's waiting for them at this. And it suddenly everything took off from there. Once I found that first-person voice of Miles, which was not evident in the screenplay at all, I had I don't want to sound pretentious here, but I felt like I had the soul, what became the soul of the book, and ultimately, I think, to some extent, the soul of the movie, and it just changed everything, and that's what made me want to write it as a book at that point. Plus, in writing a book, I had to go further in terms of creating events, and I was kind of playing off of Murphy's Law, whatever can go wrong will go wrong, and will go wrong badly, and I kept, trying to up the ante on that, and I pushed it much further than the screenplay. But it was that first person narrating voice was the galvanic charge, the thing that put me over the top in terms of writing it, and I wrote it very fast from that point.
You wrote another novel, I think it was called La Purisma, right? Which is the purism in Spanish, right?
La Purisima.
La Purisima. And I've read that you shopped it a lot of places through a couple of agents, and like Miles, the character in Sideways, ultimately couldn't get it published. Right. What did that do to your sense of yourself as a writer?
Well, that was the first novel I wrote that tried to reinvent myself. And La Purisma, it's actually the name of the golf course that I would go up and play. And there was nobody. It's a great golf course up there, and there was nobody on it midweek. And it was a place to really, get away from the burdens of my life and everything else. And it was really a mystery novel. It was about a down and out screenwriter who meets this older semi-retired private investigator. And the older guy slowly draws him into a mystery that leads down through Hollywood. And at the end, he kind of matriculates as a private investigator. And to me, it was almost a parallel to what I was trying to do. I was trying to reinvent myself as a novelist, and in this case, a mystery, which would have, successive, adventures with these two characters. And the good news is it got me a great agent. My agent, prior to that, I said, had passed away from AIDS, and it got me a terrific agent, Jess Taylor, and we shopped it around for a year, and we got very close at a couple of places, but it was tough. And so I threw all of that into the Miles character, the frustration of getting close with something, and then it just doesn't happen for whatever reason.
What is your life like these days in with this kind of success?
Well, I live in the same rent control house I do in Santa Monica, but instead of having process servers at my door that I would never answer, and having rejection letters coming in the mail, it hasn't really changed that much. I can buy some wines I normally couldn't afford, and I can eat out occasionally, which I couldn't do before. But from the standpoint of writing, it hasn't changed. I still have to go inside. I still have to really draw on something that is there. I mean, in some ways, there's a lot of distractions right now. It's very easy to like go on the internet and type in Sideways and Rex Pickett or Alexander Payne and see all these wonderful articles come up and everything. So it's distracting. And the key right now is just to really focus on writing the next thing for me. So really, my life hasn't changed that much, to be honest with you.
Well, Rex Pickett, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Novelist and screenwriter Rex Pickett. His book Sideways is now a film directed by Alexander Payne. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by The Teaching Company, offering video and audio recordings of courses by college professors. Their catalog, The Great Courses, is available at 800-LEARN-98. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Jonathan Coet's autobiographical and heartbreaking documentary Tarnation about his mentally ill mother has been 20 years in the making, beginning with film footage he shot as a 10-year-old to chronicle his troubled childhood. Coming up, we meet Jonathan Coet. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Arc of Justice by Kevin Boyle. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. For most people, family mental illness is a deeply private matter. But Jonathan Coet has told the story of his mother's psychosis in a remarkable new film, Tarnation, which is drawn from audio and video diaries he kept dating back to age 10. Tarnation tells Coet and his mother Renee LeBlanc's story with a mix of painful detail and surrealistic images. Critic Anthony Lane called Tarnation a daunting blend of head trip, cinema verite, music video, and auto therapy. Renee LeBlanc suffered decades of psychotic breaks and hospitalizations, along with harrowing experiences which sometimes involved her son. When Coet was 5, his mother took him to Chicago, where she was raped in front of him by a man who'd picked them up on the street. Coet was raised largely by his grandparents in Texas and suffered mental health problems as well, but did better when he moved to New York in his 20s. In 2002, Renee LeBlanc suffered a lithium overdose, which left her with some brain damage. After that, she began speaking of childhood abuse, saying she wasn't even raised by her own parents. In this scene from Tarnation, Renee is being interviewed by Coet in his apartment in New York.
Rosemary was the woman who raised me. She was schizophrenic. She was very neurotic, and she was very psychotic. She would hit me on my back. She would hit me with her fist for no apparent reason. I was extremely abused, and hopefully I didn't bring over any of the abuse to my children. I wanted to be the one to break the cycle.
Tell me about the accident. What happened?
Nothing. I fell out the window.
What was the accident?
I fell out.
What was your first memory of the first mental hospital that you went into? Tell me. No, tell me, because it's not your fault, Renee.
No, it's not.
It's not your fault.
No, it's not.
You have nothing to run away from.
I'm sick, okay?
You're not sick.
Oh, yes, I am now.
Will you just please help me with my stupid film?
My stomach can't take this.
Talk to me.
I spoke to Jonathan Coet last week. Jonathan Coet, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, hello.
Yeah, good to have you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
How is your mother doing?
Oh, thanks for asking. she's actually doing fine. I just road tripped her back from New York to Texas by way of car about 6 weeks ago, and you know, it was a good experiment to have her with me for the year and a half that she lived with me and my boyfriend in Queens, because it was really the first, you know, available scenario within arm's length that I could think of for her, you know, after she had had her accident with lithium toxicity. And, you know, although the medical system is a lot better in New York, theoretically, it's just, you know, getting her sort of reinstated there and having that be her new atmosphere was just too overwhelming for her. It just, you know, because New York can tend to be a really hostile place, and
right.
it just wasn't her bag of beans. So I just decided to, you know, get her back into her habitat, and you know, the quality of life for her, I think, is substantially a lot better, you know, down in Texas and Houston. And I just got her own apartment and this kind of thing. And, you know, I have to tell you that the life of this film cannot be over soon enough. And I say that with love, but I say that real specifically because, you know, I can't wait to get back to Texas to not only kind of multitask and, you know, simultaneously work on my next film, but also get a better handle on my grandfather and my mother's situation in a way that I've never been able to do before.
You're now too busy with all this and can't.
I am. It's quite a dichotomy because it's like I'm promoting this film, but on the same note, you know, that my family's livelihood and health are just, you know, really kind of thin ice-ish right now. You know, I really need to get back there and really take care of them in a way that I've never been able to before.
Has your mother seen the film?
She has seen the film, and she absolutely adores the film. You know, I was petrified when I showed it to her. I remember the first time I did show it to her. I was in a theater with about 500 cineastes in New York's East Village at the Anthology Film Archives when it premiered at the Mix Film Festival, when it was now, you know, looking back, pretty much a work in progress. It had a much different ending. It was a much longer film. It was about 2 hours. And it wasn't, you know, it was the first time I not only came out to her by way of the film, but the first time that she had seen any of this.
Oh, she didn't know you were gay until that?
She didn't know I was gay. She didn't really know about, all the content in the film. And I was, I think psychically between both of us, we must have had small coronaries. She was sitting four seats down from me, but... You know, we talked about it, and she knows that between her and I that we've often had a pretty poignant story that we've had to get out there. And I never realized really, and she never realized that it was gonna be, by way of the real McCoy of footage just kind of hovering under my nose the whole time. I mean, I had always wanted to do it as a narrative with actors. That was my first real idea for telling our story. And then there was a second time, the second seedling where I was going to incorporate this footage was I had written this 97-page screenplay that was kind of like, it was me and my boyfriend and Renee, my mother, under completely imaginary circumstances, but playing ourselves, living in our house in New York. And it was going to be this sort of parapsychological horror film that was going to be kind of like an elongated Twilight Zone episode, loosely based on the structure of Rosemary's Baby. And it was going to, I was going to utilize the stuff that you see in Tarnation Now as flashback and flash forward sequences for this completely fictitious script. And it was sort of a safe way of using the footage by not necessarily saying, well, this is me, this is really my mother, this is, really the circumstances that we've had to endure.
In the end, you've opted for this very self-revelatory story in which we see, this really heartbreaking story of your mother and those wonderful pictures of her as a girl and a young woman, so full of beauty and promise.
Yes.
I wonder if seeing it made her think differently about what she'd gone through and, her own role in it.
I don't know. I don't know if she, I think she constantly talks to me about what she could have been and what, there is a window of her, the real pure self of her that's being infiltrated through what she suffers, So I do get glimpses of, maybe the early version of her that does come out sometimes, and it's very haunting to me.
Can you tell us, tell the audience?
Yes.
When did your mom's mental problems first appear? I mean, it was before you were born, of course.
It was before I was born, and from what I gather, I don't know the whole truth verbatim, because there's really nobody of sound mind that I can gather the truth from. Sound mind people being of my immediate family, my grandfather and my mother, and then the rest of our extended family, they don't really talk to us much because we're sort of the black sheep of the family, I suppose. But so I can only play the idea of what I think the story is, and from what I understand, my mother was I think about 12 years old, and she was playing on a roof of our house, the roof of our house, and fell off the roof, and she landed on the concrete without bending her knees, and it caused some sort of paralysis of some kind. I don't know the whole story, but long story short, my grandparents, having their own idiosyncrasies, and I'm assuming now being very prone to the power of suggestion, had taken some ill-fated advice from a neighbor to give her shock treatments, and she ended up just sort of being a victim of the archaic Texas mental health system for the rest of her life from there on out. And she had been in and out of about 100 psychiatric hospitals, and she was a victim of getting electroshock therapy for about 2 or 3 years on and off, almost on a, every other weekly basis. And it's a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy.
You say in the film that evidence now indicates that there was never really anything wrong with her.
Right. And I've gathered this from just talking to her. I've talked to a few of her childhood friends, and, she was a wild girl from what I understand, but there was never anything sort of mentally wrong with her from what they say.
My guest is filmmaker Jonathan Coet. His film is called Tarnation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Coet. His film Tarnation tells the story of his mother's mental illness, drawing on recordings Coet made dating back to age 10. You had some tough times yourself. I mean, apart from the difficult things that you went through early on, you had an unfortunate experience with a drug, right? I mean, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I smoked a cocktail. It was my one and only drug experience. I had wanted to experiment with pot when I was 12. And unfortunately, it was laced with formaldehyde and angel dust, which had catapulted me into hospitals. And I was eventually diagnosed with something called depersonalization disorder, which, you know, it's a condition that kind of makes you feel like you're dreaming all the time.
Do you still suffer from that?
No, not. I'm either very acclimated to it or it doesn't exist anymore, really. But it was something I've had to deal with since the time I was about 12 until, you know, I guess around the time I was 21. And I don't know if it's quite subsided yet, but, you know, I don't know.
There were some remarkable effects in this film, some quick cuts and split screens and special effects. What were you getting at with those sequences?
One of my whole objectives with making the film was, you know, it was based loosely on a couple of experiences, really. The one of the experiences was when I was 9 years old, and I had walking pneumonia, and I had about 104 degrees of fever. And I got very, very sick, very delusional with a high fever. And I just remembered that experience very vividly. And then I think around the time I was, I guess, young adult, you know, late teenager, young adult, I became really cognizant that I was having these other experiences that were sort of torn from that same cloth as the waking pneumonia experience. And it was that sort of borderline place where you're half asleep and you're half awake and you're about to, you know, go off into dreamland. And there's this whole plethora of information that kind of rushes into your mind's eye. And it's like a story or a poem or an idea for a movie or whatever it is. And it kind of goes in, you know, it's in your mind's eye for just a moment, and it kind of makes sense for a millisecond. And then it just sort of dissipates into the universe. And you're like, well what was that? You know, like a fever dream. But anyway, for the film, I sort of wanted to like lucidly transpose that experience cinematically, and that's what I was hoping to kind of achieve with this film. You know, just everything about it aesthetically, with all the text being thrown out at you at machine gun speed, and just, you know, all this stuff happening so maniacally. But it was more about evoking a feeling, I think, initially when I made the film, as opposed to telling a narrative story.
When you described that a moment ago, I mean,
yeah,
when that description of what that moment of like really sounds like what I felt when I was watching the film.
Are you serious?
It really did. I mean, and I have to say that watching it, there were moments when I would get kind of a little annoyed. I would say, I want to get back to the story, but it was really powerful and affecting. And I'm wondering, you're sitting at a computer screen with all of this, lots and lots of tapes and music.
Right.
How do you recapture that sensation on a screen?
I'm not exactly sure, because it was very kind of subconscious and unconscious, but all I can tell you is that, you know, everything had been digitized prior to doing this film, and I was literally pulling out tapes from my shelf that were living and breathing on Hi8 and importing them into the computer, and I would usually start with a song and just kind of start cutting to the song, and whatever I was, you know, feeling emotionally from the music, I would just try to match that, you know, visually. And I just, you know, somebody said the other day, if cinema didn't exist, somebody asked me if cinema didn't exist, what I would do. And I, you know, I told him I'd probably be, you know, busking on a street corner in Austin, Texas, if I knew how to play, you know, acoustic guitar or whatever. I'm a big music junkie, and I just would always start with music and just kind of work my way out. And in the original cut of the film, the musical montages, you know, served more as chapter breaks. And in between the musical montages, there was much more cinema verite. When I did one of the first montages, when I actually had Nick Drake music in the film originally, I was thinking to myself, you know, well, if I was going to do the story of my life and my mother's life, what would I want the first song to be? And I put the CD in and kind of went to town. And it was just, you know, very, very spontaneous.
Right. Well, if you're off on a filmmaking career, do you want to tell us about your next project now?
Oh, sure. That's an easy one. I'm going to be going back to Texas in about, I guess, a couple of months, and I'm going to be living, I'm going to be kind of multitasking and actually moving back in with my grandfather in my old bedroom. I'm going to set up an editing bay, and the reason I'm doing that is to kind of be sort of more proactively available to him and my mother, you know, to help them in a way that, you know, as I said, never been able to do before. And at the same time, I'm just going to take my computer with me and work on my next film. And the next film is going to be, I'm taking three major motion pictures that were all made in succession consecutively from the years of 1973 to 1977. And in all three of these films, they all star this one actress who, I can't say who it is verbatim, but I can kind of generalize it. And she actually assumes the same aesthetic throughout all of the films, right down to her hair length and, you know, her accent, and who she is even as a character in all three of these films kind of is a very similar kind of character. She sort of denotes a sense of scapegoatism. And my fantasy is to get all three films free of underscore and free of music, and just using the split-track dialogue derived from the masters of the films. And I want to basically re-augment them and remix them into a new two-hour film that's going to tell and evoke a completely different story. And I was talking to David Lynch's producer, actually, out in at the Cannes Film Festival, one of his producers. And I told him, you know, I was just kind of, I guess, sort of maybe throwing, just talking with him about it. You know, I wasn't trying to hit him up for anything necessarily about the project, but I told him there's this thing I want to do, and it would be a one day for fun thing as a way to sort of give back to the Mix Film Festival, you know, kind of like an under the wire, underground sort of no rights incurred, no distribution, like a Todd Haynes superstar Karen Carpenter story.
Back to your roots.
Back to my roots. And, you know, he got so excited about it that he actually wants to come on and produce the film. So that's pretty amazing. And I'm still sort of in a place where I'll see it when I believe it too, because of all the rights issues and whatnot. But I think it'd be like the same notion of taking a song, and sampling it and just kind of running with it in a slightly broader way.
Wow. Sounds ambitious. So, we'll look forward to it.
It's going to be a little crazy.
Well, Jonathan Coet, thanks so much. I wish you the best in taking care of your family and wish the best for your mom.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Coet. His film Tarnation is now in theaters. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan on Arc of Justice, a book about race and class issues in a 1925 Detroit murder case. This is Fresh Air. Kevin Boyle is a historian who's written about the rise of the labor movement. His new book, called Arc of Justice, delves into early 20th century working class life, centering on a notorious Detroit murder case in 1925, in which political forces of progressivism encountered currents of racism. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Kevin Boyle's new book, Arc of Justice, is one of those narrative histories that stumbles upon what looks to be a relatively minor incident from the past, excavates it, and then claims to have actually discovered a motherlode of revelations crucial to understanding an entire age. This kind of high-stakes prospecting approach to historical writing doesn't always work. But when it pays off, as Arc of Justice does, it pays off big. Like other masterworks of this genre, I'm thinking, for example, of J. Anthony Lucas's Big Trouble and Linda Gordon's The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction, Arc of Justice tells a tale imbued with the simplicity and seemingly sick inevitability of a great American tragedy, yet one in which the struggle waged by its actors reminds us that history's protagonists sometimes resist and even transform the inevitable. The events Boyle recounts here were set in motion by the quintessential American dream of home ownership. In 1925, a young black doctor named Ocean Sweet returned to Detroit from Europe, where he'd been studying with scientific luminaries like Marie Curie. Sweet and his wife Gladys put a down payment on a nice bungalow in the white part of town. Sweet wasn't ignorant of Detroit's de facto housing segregation, and he also knew that about a month before he and Gladys moved in, some 700 white people gathered for an angry meeting of a local neighborhood improvement association. So he and Gladys packed guns and ammunition along with their household goods and invited family and friends to sit watch with them during the first few nights in their new home. On the first night, a mob of whites gathered outside, but nothing much happened. On the second night, all hell broke loose. Here's how Boyle describes what Sweet saw as he flung open his front door to let in his brother, who was trapped outside. There it was, the scene he'd dreaded all his life, the moment when he stood facing a sea of white faces made grotesque by unreasoned, unrestrained hate for his race, for his people, for him. His brother and a friend were standing right in front of Ocean on the porch, terror-struck. The people on the other side of the street were screaming, "There they go! Get them! Get them!" Stones were raining down from across the street, smashing into the lawn, crashing onto the painted wooden floor of the porch. Then, from the upstairs bedroom of the Sweet home, shots rang out. It was never exactly clear who fired them, but one white man was killed, another wounded. The police promptly arrested Gladys and Ocean Sweet and the nine other Negroes in the house, and all were charged with conspiring to commit murder with malice aforethought. Boyle opens Arc of Justice with this suspenseful scene, but in addition to transfixing readers, it also sets us up to be educated. Even the most sympathetic of readers might wonder if Ocean Sweet wasn't foolhardy in choosing to move across the color line. That's the moment when Boyle really goes into action, dazzling us with the sweep of his erudition. We learn about Sweet's background as the son of poor Florida farmers, brought up in the gospel of racial uplift. We hear about his time as a scholarship student at all-black Wilberforce and Howard, where he was charged with a sense of social responsibility as a potential member of what W.E.B. Du Bois heralded as the talented tenth of his race. We also come to understand the forces of history swirling around Sweet, the birth of the NAACP in 1909, the overwhelming invasion of the Ku Klux Klan into Detroit, the nasty contests between the proponents of racial and ethnic nativism and the champions of progressivism in Detroit politics in the 1920s. By the time Boyle is done filling us in on the larger context, Sweet's terrified but defiant stand in that bungalow seems like the act of a man who was shaped by his upbringing and his particular historical moment to be both a heroic protagonist and a pawn of fate. A man who, to paraphrase an unfashionable genius, made his own history but did not make it as he pleased. And that's only the first half of Arc of Justice. The second half consists of a nail-biter of a prolonged courtroom drama starring none other than the aging scourge of reactionary thinking, Clarence Darrow, the only white lawyer at the time who would work with the black attorneys on the defense team. Darrow had only 2 weeks to prepare, yet he brilliantly reframed the case into one in which American racism itself was put on trial. Boyle concludes Arc of Justice with an overview of how so many of the principal players in the Ocean Suite case went on to work with Roosevelt's New Deal and other progressive movements to shift America away from the brutal intolerance of the 1920s. One of those New Dealers was originally the mainstay of the hostile prosecution team, and that's just one of the many dramatic ironies that inform the spectacular story of Jazz Age injustice and measured redemption.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Arc of Justice, a saga of race, civil rights, and murder in the Jazz Age by Kevin Boyle. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of poems and tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease, on the web at alz.org, and from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Lord John and the Private Matter, the first Lord John Gray novel by Diana Gabaldon, author of Outlander. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants, the hyperactive, incurably optimistic animated sponge who lives in the seat and stars in a Nickelodeon cartoon, soon to appear in his own feature film. Join us for the next Fresh Air.